Irish Illustrated Insider subscribers. This is Drew Medtalk, and I'm here to bring you the 12th episode from a bi-weekly podcast series in the feed, Irish Illustrated Interviews. Today, we're sharing my conversation with Trevor Ruland, a former Notre Dame offensive guard who served as the sixth man on some of the greatest lines in program history. He played for the Fighting Irish from 2015 to 2019. We discuss what it was like to be sandwiched between several All-Americans on the offensive line and the wear and tear he endured that ultimately led to 8 surgeries. Trevor also offers some unique stories on the Joe Moore Award and playing for former offensive line coach Harry Hiestand. Our conversation goes into some of the struggles he faced and has worked to overcome in his life after football. That includes an eating disorder that he developed while he grasped for control during the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, his story doesn't end there. After years of hardship, he's come out of that dark place and has been sharing his story in recent months so that others can benefit and know the importance of asking for help. Here's my interview with Trevor. What's up, everyone? I'm here with former Notre Dame offensive lineman Trevor Ruland, who played with the Fighting Irish from 2015 to 2019. You're part of some of the best offensive lines in program history and helped the Irish make its first ever college football playoff appearance back when it was still a 4-team field in 2018. Upon graduation, you entered the workforce and transitioned into life after football, which I think, no matter how long you've played the game, can be difficult, and you had your own unique struggles that you've overcome. And we'll definitely get to that later in the podcast. Trevor, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Hey, happy to be here. I love that piece on making it to the playoffs as a 4-team back when it was challenging, yeah. As I joke. But yeah, loved every step of the way. So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And so you're from Cary, Illinois, which is about a three-hour drive from Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what's your first recollection of the university and the football team?
I hope this doesn't make your listeners mad, but my father played for the University of Iowa. A lot of my family members are Hawkeyes, my mother included. That's where they met. And I think if you're from the Chicago suburbs, you either grow up loving Notre Dame or hating Notre Dame. And I grew up not liking the Catholic private school, to be honest with you. I thought I was going to be Big Ten through and through. I remember being a little boy running around with Ruland on the back of my Iowa jersey and playing at a public high school. I always kind of looked down on the private schools in high school, like, oh, they would recruit people and they were all affiliated with religion, right? I'm born and raised Catholic, a proud member of the Catholic Church, but I never envisioned myself going to Notre Dame. But, you know, as you start to get recruited and you bounce around school to school, you get influenced. Large influence was from my parents. They were like, dude, you can go to Notre Dame for free, and that's close to us, and we can visit whenever we want. And I'm like, okay, fine, I'll take a visit and go to camp there. And you walk on campus one time, and it's cheesy, but it's true. It's a pretty special place walking around campus, and, you know, having a great football program is just a plus on that.
And what are some of the Big Ten schools that you were also looking at?
Yeah, I always wanted to go to Iowa. Obviously, yeah. I'm still an Iowa fan. My parents still haven't gotten over the point I didn't go there, but they actually never recruited me. I took one visit there. And it's not like my dad was a knucklehead or did anything wrong. He was like a 2-time All Big Ten defensive lineman. So it wasn't like we had a bad last name or bad reputation there. They even let my mom graduate from there, as I joke. Love you, Mom. No, I always wanted to go to Iowa, but they said I was too small. They were looking for tackles, and I kind of was going to be on the inside. But I really liked Northwestern, being close to home. Obviously, the education piece. I liked Wisconsin. I like Michigan State. Those were kind of Minnesota was probably my number 2 school behind Notre Dame. They were my first offer. I love Coach Jerry Kill up there. Coach Matt Limegrover were the guys who recruited me. And it was kind of special being the first offer. But yeah. So those were probably the main Big Ten schools I was looking at. Wanted to stay close to home as you could tell.
Definitely. And I assume during that recruiting process, you would have been recruited by Harry Hiestand at the time. What was it like getting to know him, and how important was that to your decision to come to Notre Dame?
Yeah, Coach Hiestand's the best. You know, I laugh. I've got a lot of good stories about Coach Hiestand. And now that I look back on it, being a little bit older and a little bit wiser, I loved his approach to the recruiting process. I don't know if he could deal with it now with all NIL and probably some of the egos of things, but I think that's what makes the position of offensive line different. Kind of knew what we wanted. And he was very candid with me, and I could appreciate that being in the sales world. He was very upfront, honest. He knew what he wanted in a player. He made that very clear. I remember I got my scholarship from them on April 5th. It was my brother's birthday. That's the only reason I remember that. So I want to take the shine away from him. But that was a Friday at camp. It was either a Friday or a Saturday at camp. You know, I was excited leaving campus, like posting on Twitter, like, holy cow, Notre Dame offered. Walking around school on Monday at high school, I felt like a big deal. People were like, no way, that's awesome. He called me Monday after class and he said, so what's your decision? Like 2 or 3 days later. And I'm like, could you give me 48 hours? But he knew what he wanted in his student athletes. And he was incredibly hard on us. He made you grow up very quickly at school. I'll be very honest. There was nights and practices where I was like, no way this could work out. I cannot stand this man. Ridiculous. As I started to get older and wiser and gain respect for him, as my play improved, as I started to learn from, he's literally the best offensive line coach ever. He gained more trust in me. I trusted him more. I understood his style and why he was so hard on you. And, you know, Andrew, to be honest with you, I still have text messages from him saved that were such simple messages like, Trevor, you worked your ass off today. Keep pushing. You are going to be a special player. Like, is something as simple as that after he screamed at you for 4 hours was so special. So, you know, it's unfortunate. Right when he left for my last 2 years was finally like when it started to click. He trusted me as a player. I trusted him as a coach, but I learned so much from him. I have cheesy sayings bouncing around my head constantly that from him. Some of them have a lot of bad words in them, sayings, but Coach Hestand's the best. Very blessed to be coached by him.
I think that's an interesting perspective because we often hear the latter half of working with Coach Hestand and that hard work pays off and the standard he holds you to. But I'm sure as a 18, 19-year-old kid, that level of hard coaching, especially after you've been, you know, one of the best kids in your area all your life, is probably pretty difficult or maybe shell-shocking at first.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, I walk in from, you know, not the smallest town, but Cary, Illinois is not producing NFL players. I was the first Division I player out of Cary. So coming from, you're literally the best player within a 50-mile radius in the state, whatever it might be, to walking in that O-line room that I joined with Ronnie Stanley, Mike McGlinchey, Quentin Nelson, Alex Barr, Sam Mustafa, the list goes on and on. I'm looking around like, how am I ever going to see the field with these guys? Right? I mean, even the guys that were on the third string line with me were freaks of nature, right? And so you come in the big fish in the small pond and you get thrown into the opposite. And it's a tough lesson to learn. It humbles you real quickly. It makes you reprioritize things, makes you adjust your expectations. And I mean, you kind of that saying, you got to be a sponge. You got to soak in all the lessons you can from everybody. And thankfully that room still today has such a good culture where when I was at my lowest, when I was like, there's no way I could ever play here. I got to look elsewhere. You know, I'm struggling academically. I'm struggling football wise. I would have mentors and people like Sam Mustafa and Hunter Biven put their arm around me and be like, it's all right, man, we'll figure it out. Everybody goes through this kind of stuff. Thankfully, I had those type of people in that locker room, that brotherhood, because it ended up, you know, I'm not an All-American, but I'm very happy with the career I had.
And you touched on it, but yeah, that first year you get to school, you have three future first or top 10 picks. Nick Martin was a second round pick who's a starting center.
I forgot Nick. That's how crazy the room is.
Steve Elmer, I'm sure, could have played professionally. So you walk in and you just see this. I mean, guys who are, you know, all pros making, you know, nine figure deals or whatever in the NFL today. What was it like? I mean, you touched on like, what am I going to play here? But what was it like just seeing what they could do on the football field?
It was eye-opening. Everybody had their own ability. I think someone like Ronnie is a good example because he was so effortless with what he did. The way he would pass set, the way he would move around was just incredible. He was and is such a natural athlete where I'd look at him and I'd be like, all right, I ain't going to be like him. I can't move that cleanly. Or then you look at someone like a Nick Martin or a Mike McGlinchey who obviously have had and are having great NFL careers, But they were, not to say Ronnie didn't work his butt off, but they were kind of the opposite. They scratched and clawed and were technicians. They studied every little aspect of the game, where I would kind of look at someone like Nick and be like, okay, I can kind of model my game a little bit like him. So there's so many little pieces of information I learned from each one of them. And I think this is kind of a cool story. And some people probably know this, but not everybody. If you're deep into the O-line play, which I hope a lot of people are, you would. The Joe Moore Award goes out to the country's best O-line. And my true freshman year, my redshirt year, was the first year of that award going out. And they literally, still to this day, that trophy is modeled at about our offensive line. So an hour and a half before one of our practices at Culver at training camp, they came out and they did a bunch of pictures of us. And this is one of the only times I've seen Coach Hiestand engage with the media so much. And in the media, I think it was just like Aaron Taylor came out and took pictures of us. But we were taking all these different pictures of, like, go look at the trophy. You could literally see like Mike McGlinchey's like crossbar, and you could see Ronnie pointing, and you could see Nick reaching for the ball. And it was so funny watching Coach Hiestand like coach up the guys. All right, get in a little bit better stance for the picture. And it was just so weird to see that kind of dynamic of it. But long story short, I mean, how could you not learn so much from each one of those guys? And it was eye opening, and it showed me I had a long way to go.
That's really interesting. I had Aaron Taylor on a previous episode, and we obviously touched on the Joe Moore Award. He did not mention modeling the trophy after that, but that's a really interesting story.
Yeah, go Google the picture after this. If you can visualize those guys in their Notre Dame uniform, you could literally pick it out. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to do that. Something else I think was unique about your Notre Dame experience early in your career, I believe you only came in with one other offensive lineman, Tristan Hodge, and then Jerry Tillery transitioned immediately over to defensive tackle, or maybe even before he, on signing day, he did that. And then Tristan transferred, I think, 2 years into his career. So you usually, I feel like offensive linemen have four or five guys they're spending 4 or 5 years with, and you kind of were the only guy in your class pretty quickly. What was that like, and how did maybe you start gelling with some of the players older and younger than you?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think I missed out on that aspect, because I would look at like certain classes, and I mean, those are your brothers, right? The guys you come in with. But it really made me, you know, I was close with a lot of the other guys in my class then. I became real good friends with a lot of the walk-ons on our team, a lot of the other skill position players as well. So like Miles Boykin, Brandon Wimbush, Chris Fink, Brian Ball, Jimmy Thompson, you know, just to name a few, Lincoln Feist. Those have become some of my best friends in the world. But then, speaking from the O-line specific, I reached out to a lot of the older guys, that class right above me, you know, with Sam and Alex and Quentin, and Sam Bush as a walk-on. Those really became good friends of mine. So, and then I kind of used that as the younger classes that came in. That class below me, I really latched onto as well. So like Tommy Kramer, Liam Eichenberg, those became some of my best friends as well. So it was interesting being the only offensive line in that class. And especially as I started to get older, especially when I was a fifth year, I really was looked at as like the old man in the group, right? Because there was nobody else like me, physically as beat up as I was, but then also age-wise, because I was the only one.
And then, so you mentioned the Joe Moore Award. In 2017, the Notre Dame offensive line won that award. And then after that, when some of those guys took off, you kind of took on a bigger role over the next, your final 2 years in Notre Dame. What was it like to play behind those guys and then start getting those opportunities? And you mentioned after Coach Easton had left.
Yeah, I think there was a big leadership gap there for a little bit when all those guys kind of took off, especially later in my career. And when we started to make that transition to Coach Quinn, and I love Coach Jeff Quinn. He's the man. He'd be the first guy to go fishing and get a beer with on my list. Just a very different coaching style. Was still tough on you, but he was a little bit more personal off the field as well, which I think was perfect for me. I learned a lot from Coach Hiestand, and Coach Quinn came in, kind of eased up a little bit and made me enjoy my last 2 years, have a little bit more fun with it. But I think that what was important about that transition as I started to get older was trying to keep the culture strong. And they've done a great job of that still to this day, is just the little traditions we have as an O-line. So you look at them now, they still fist bump before every single play. I still know they keep a lot of those cheesy sayings we're talking about. So still watching film after practice every single day. All those kind of things are very important to us as a brotherhood. And that's the Notre Dame way. Watch them come out of the tunnel on Saturday. Who are the first guys standing there right next to Coach Freeman? It's the offensive line. That's what the program has been built on. And that's what we take pride on. And I mean, I got goosebumps right now talking about it. I love that room. I love what we built. And it was kind of our job to kind of transition into the next era of athletes. And I was lucky enough to, like I said, I was no All-American, but I was sandwiched between a lot of All-Americans. So when the classes above me graduated, it was not my job to fill their roles physically and be an ass kicker like all them. I would have loved to do that a little bit more effectively, but it was my job to kind of keep the traditions going and pass it on to guys like Tommy and Liam and Banks and Hainsey so they could keep the tradition going. And they did. And then they passed it to the next era of the next All-Americans, because that list is long and proudful. So that was kind of my job as a transition guy, I guess.
Nice. And over those 2 years, I don't think you had either season where you started every game, but you were coming in either if a guy got hurt or taking on different roles. What was it like to kind of taking on that role where maybe you didn't come out of fall camp as the full-time starter, but you were ready to go? And I think even some, at least 2019, I believe you started at both left and right guard at various points throughout the year. So you kind of had to be ready to do different roles.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we could touch on it, but I was physically beat up. I have had many injuries and ailments in my playing career. So I always was told by Coach Hiestand and then Coach Quinn, I basically served the role as sixth man for, 3.5, 4 years there. So be as versatile as possible, be as smart as possible. I wasn't the biggest, I wasn't the strongest guy, but I needed to know how to play left guard, how to play right guard, how to serve as an emergency tackle during practice, how to learn how to snap the football. That was something I never did until I was a junior in college. Honestly, I didn't play a whole lot of center, but I loved it. That was where I was probably best. I just was needed to fill in at the guard positions. So being able to be versatile, being able to coach up the second unit in practice, those were kind of the things that I was tasked with and something I took pride in, because if I was going to see the field, it was be the plug-in guy. And it had its own unique set of challenges, being able to flip everything mentally in my head, be able to flip everything physically. But that's what I was good at, is when I knew I wasn't going to be able to go bench 225, 30 something times like Quentin Nelson or run like the wind like Robert Hainsey, right? I knew I needed to study the playbook a little bit more, watch a little bit extra film, understand where the blitzes were coming from, be a good communicator and be versatile. And that was my path to the field.
Awesome. And what are some of the injuries? I mean, I'm trying to remember, I think in 2019, I feel like you had an upper body injury that you were fighting through. Blanking on the specifics, but if you could talk a little bit about that and maybe the ways you had to also adjust to something like that, maybe if your strength was compromised or mobility at any point as well.
Yeah. I mean, how long is this podcast?
it depends how much time you have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've had 8 surgeries now.
Wow.
I just had my knee replaced about a year and a half ago. So obviously that's from playing football, the wear and tear. Thankfully, my wife nursed me back through that. But in college, I had a few. My left knee has always been the banged up spot. I broke my elbow going into senior night, my true senior year. That sucked. I tore both my pec muscles.
Okay.
And it was really the knee that drove me nuts. It was constantly getting worked on, constantly getting shots, PRP injections, draining all the fluid out of it. Because it truly is bone or was bone. Now it's a robot. Was bone on bone. There was no cartilage in it. I've had everything done in it, thankfully, but the ACL. So those were kind of the ailments. So at the end of my career, thankfully to Coach Quinn, he would always come up to me in the stretch lines and he'd be like, "Big dog, how you feeling today?" I'd be like, Coach, it's a Wednesday." So the goal was every week, make it to game day. I lived in the training room. Rob Hunt, Mike Bean, shout out, the best trainers in the world. They've gotten to know me very well, especially since I went back and got my knee replaced by them and Coach Dr. Radigan. Even today, when we're watching games on TV, my wife Nina will always point out, "Hey, there's Bean, there's Rob," because she's gotten to know them personally from our time in South Bend rehabbing. But you know, physically, the pecs killed a lot of my strength. You know, I probably went from benching 225 probably upwards of 28 times to having to lift with boards on my chest and rubber bands because I didn't want my boobies to blow again. The knee really shot a lot of my speed and quickness. Like I said, I wasn't going to be as fast, as strong as some of the other guys. So I had to learn to compensate for that stuff. So be smart and be versatile were the biggest things that I had to lean on.
Was that difficult in the moment at times to process maybe what you feel like you could do without the injuries versus what you were maybe fighting through it and, you know, getting out there to do for the team and how you performed?
Yeah, it sucked. It definitely sucked because, I mean, there was a time where I was super strong and super athletic and I felt like a true ass kicker. And, you know, at the end of my career, I was literally the walking wounded. I would walk around after practice with six ice bags on both my knees. So it was definitely an adjustment. But you got to laugh at some of this stuff, man. It was, you know, I think they want to rename the training room after my name, but it's not something that's unique. Maybe the extreme amount was for me, but the injury rate in football is 100%.
Right.
You can't go into a season without expecting to lose contributors to your football team. So building the depth and, you know, training the younger players on your team to fill in is more and more critical, especially with longer playoffs and things like that going on now. It's incredibly important. So my story is not a sad one. It's an everyone deals with this kind of stuff. Maybe the knee replacement at 27 is unique, but
yeah.
Other than that, everybody gets hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking back on it, as I mentioned at the top, you had a college football playoff run that you contribute to for sure. And you guys still won 11 games your fifth year. But I'm curious, what are, looking back on it, maybe what are some highlights that stick out to you from your time in South Bend, or if there's, you know, a certain moment or game that you really remember fondly?
Yeah, there's a few, man. I loved it. I really did. I truly am blessed and lucky to be able to do that. And I lived my dream, and not many people get to say they did that. Something I'm very fortunate about was, like I said, I wanted to stay close to home because I got a very supportive family. My folks bought a fixer-upper on Notre Dame Avenue. If you walk to the front of the driveway, you could see the Golden Dome. And they got it for, a steal, and they put in some blood, sweat, equity into that home. And just about every single home game, we piled that house high with folks. So family and friends. I think my senior night, I had 30-something people there.
Wow.
Looking back at those pictures, I don't recognize myself anymore as the hairy giant, but it makes me very proud of what I did. It makes me very, very thankful for my parents that they did that for me. I know they loved every second of it as well. So they could say they did it for me, but I know they also did it for all the tailgating and all the fun experiences and to show off South Bend and the hard work that they put in and that I put in. But a little bit more specifically than just all those good times of family and friends, my first start at Wake Forest, I think it was 115 degrees on the turf. I don't remember that because I took so many IVs and things like that. That was super fun, getting to play next to my best friends for the first time after 3.5, 4 years of hard work. So starting my first game was special. I remember after that game, my dad was standing there. He made the trip because I found out I was starting on like a Wednesday afternoon. Called him and he booked his ticket to Winston-Salem. I remember him crying after the game, giving me a big hug, how proud he was of me, and then checking my phone and just seeing all the messages and the text messages. It was so cool. And then that same year when we played at Virginia Tech, big, loud game, right? And I remember just the stadium being empty at the end of the game, besides for the little section of Notre Dame fans way up in the nosebleed. So going to Lane Stadium and making that place silent was cool. And then the last trip, I know I'm rambling because there's so many good times.
No, this is great.
The last trip to the bowl game in Orlando to play Iowa State. Like I said at the beginning of the call, still a Hawkeye fan. whole family's Hawkeyes, so to beat Iowa State the way we did was awesome. And those bowl games in Orlando is a fun city. So those first couple of nights we were down there in Orlando are some of my favorite, man. I do miss it. There's no way in hell I can go to a Tuesday, Wednesday practice right now. No way. But the times in the locker room, the times in the training room, the times on the bus and the airplane, the bowl games, things like that, those are things that I'll take to my grave as some of the best times of my life.
And I think you beat Iowa State 30-3 or something along those lines. So it was pretty thorough victory.
I remember the last drive of that game, and we just ran the ball out. There was like 3 minutes left, right? The game was over. And I'm looking at the sideline and they're subbing guys out, right? They're getting some of my classmates, some of the seniors in who haven't played much into the game. And I'm looking at Coach Quinn and I'm like, you could have subbed me out, coach, like curtain call kind of thing. You know, I wasn't expecting the stadium to give a standing ovation, but like, you gonna sub me out, coach? He's like, you didn't come this effing far to get subbed out on the last drive of your career. You're in there to the end. I'm like, oh my gosh. Dude, I'm just in so much pain at the end of it. But that was fun, man. Tony Jones had an awesome long run in that game. And yeah, to beat the clowns like that feels good.
Awesome. And then so after that, you after the 2019 season, you transition, as we mentioned, to life after football. I actually noticed in your LinkedIn you did an internship with Wilson Sports. My wife also did an internship immediately after graduating in 2014 and looks back on that fondly. But what was that like after all the injuries you had overcome? I'm sure there's maybe some parts where, as you mentioned, those Tuesday, Wednesday practices and maybe not having to push through that, maybe there's some relief. But what was it like kind of moving on from that phase of your life?
It was weird. It was real weird. You know, playing college football is a full-time job. You know, you're there in the summers, you're there all day, every day working. So I thought I did deserve some time off. So the plan was to take a little bit of time, relax, recover, you know, hang out with some family, some friends, and start to slowly interview for some sales positions in the Chicagoland area. And then boom, COVID hit for long for a lot of things, a lot of positions. So it was weird. I was back home. That was always the plan, was to save some money and then probably rent a place with a few of my buddies that were in similar positions in the area. So it was strange. I was bored. There wasn't a whole lot to do, but it did feel good for a while. I physically felt great not having to go to practice, lost some weight, was starting to enjoy some things again, starting to, you know, I'm gonna go get a little bicep curl in, like go to the gym casually. Like those kind of things were fun to do at first. But it did get boring real quick, just being at home with my family who I love. But yeah, it was strange, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. I can't imagine graduating during COVID. I'm sure that was, yeah, I can't imagine trying to figure that stuff out and everything's kind of on hold and you're used to being around all your teammates and things like that. Then all of a sudden you're going from that to not knowing what you're doing every day and not being around very many people.
Yeah, it was weird. One of the cool stories and one of the blessings about that, selfishly, COVID was very challenging for a lot of people, right? So I understand that. I had my own unique challenges with it being away from people, but one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my life, and maybe the best thing, is I was home from school, wasn't able to meet many people, wasn't able to go out. So downloaded a dating app, right? Just to meet some people in the area. And sure enough, that is why I am where I am and why I have a ring on my finger, because I met my beautiful wife. And I remember the first time we were going to go on a date, we were going to walk our dogs, our family dogs. And she gave me her address and I typed it in and it was 6 minutes from my house.
Oh,
She
wow.
literally lived across the river from me. Greatest blessing of my life. I don't know how I got that lucky, but that was the best thing that ever happened from COVID.
That's great. I also met my wife on a dating app several years before that, but yeah, I
Ah,
can
there we
relate a little
go.
bit. Yeah.
There we go. See, it works.
Yeah, I
It
agree.
works.
I don't know if it's everybody's experience, but yeah, there are
No,
some positive test
there's
case.
some weirdos out there, but there's some beautiful women like her that I'm looking at as she takes her dog to the vet right now.
As you mentioned there, you also, as you transitioned to life after football, there were some struggles. I know you recently wrote like a three-part essay for Blue and Gold Illustrated, kind of outlined some of your struggles with
weight loss and mm-hmm. it sounds like an eating disorder. What was it like to kind of start going through that stuff and then also getting to the point where you overcame it?
Yeah. I could talk about this forever as I have been here recently. And like I said, it was the transition post-college was weird and it came with its challenges. As a student athlete, as an athlete, you try to control everything you can, right? Your schedule, your time, everything like that. Almost every part of your day is controlled. So when I left school and I was just spit out, there was no control. You're just, what are you going to do today? I don't know. I don't have any classes today. I don't have any practice today. I don't have a job yet, right? Weird. So I tried to latch on to, and this is something I'm working on, is to let go of all the control and things I can't control. But something I did know I could control was what I ate, what I was doing to work out, and trying to lose weight. There was always a point where I wanted to lose weight. I didn't need to be a 315-pound offensive lineman, right? I didn't want to look like that, and it wasn't healthy, right? There's a healthy point of weight where I should be. Thankfully, I'm at that point right now in my life, but I let the control get to me. I would wake up every single day in the morning and jump on the scale, and man, I would be pissed off if I didn't lose a pound overnight or whatever it would be. I would, all right, I'm not eating today, or I'm going to go run on the treadmill, or, you know, bad thoughts were in my head. I developed an eating disorder. I developed anorexia. It's still something I think about. I'm at the point where I'm healthy and happy, very happy. So I don't want this to be a sad story. I'm over it. Always will be on my mind. Always will be working on it, but I'm at a good point now. There was a point where I was probably down to about 140 pounds. I was miserable. I was consumed by the disease. I was not fun to be around. I was evil, hot-headed, not the go-along happy guy that I wanted to be. I hurt a lot of people, my in-laws, especially my wife. I was not the man that I was raised to be. And it's hard to speak about because I think I lost years of my life. You know, I always say this specific story, but we were living down in Dallas for a while, my wife and I, and we were flying back home from my sister's graduation party. And I couldn't lift my backpack in the overhead compartment of the airplane. And I had to have her do it. And there were some really dark times. I remember just crying at the foot of the bed. I remember a lot of bad things. You know, as I started to get better, I started to write down things. I think as the population, men, we're getting better, but we struggle right. at being vulnerable and being open with our feelings. We're getting better. I'll give us credit with that, but we still need to improve talking about these things that are hard, right? And talking about our feelings. Shit, I'm sorry for swearing, but
no, you're good.
I'm an example of needing to be able to reach out for help, right? So I started to write things down and write notes to Nina, my wife, or my in-laws, or my parents about like how I'm sorry and like what's going on in my head. And as I started to do that, they kept pushing me to try to like publish it or get it out there to people to share my message and see if I could help anybody. And to be honest with you, I don't know why I was so scared at first. Maybe I had this image I was trying to uphold, even though everybody knew I was sick and struggling with this. They wanted me to release and try to help people. And I think I finally got the courage then to do that, like we talked about at the beginning of this call. And I did. And my life has been crazy since then. That was almost probably 6 months ago now. And my life has been so much better. I've had my phone, man, those next 2 days felt like I was just starting for a football game for the first time. The amount of outreach, support, and love I got was incredible. I'm not alone in doing this. I don't have the answers. There is no solution to something like this. Life after sports is very challenging when your identity is stripped from you. And I would say my biggest message here, and then I'll get off my soapboxes.
Very good.
I would say my biggest message is it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to not ask for help. I was so selfish with my time. I was lying to people around me saying I was okay. And like I said, I feel like I lost 2 years of my life every time. And I, Andrew, I loved my time down in Dallas. I loved it. But that was probably when I was at my sickest. We went down there this summer for a wedding. And when we landed and then we were taking the Uber to our hotel and we were driving by some of the places I recognized, man, I had tears in my eyes because I was like, I could have enjoyed this so much more. Why did I let this thing consume me and zap years of my life? So now I feel like I owe a lot of people around me apologies, and I have apologized and I've healed a lot of those relationships. I'm just very blessed and lucky to be at a much better place in my life, because there was a long time where I didn't think I was going to be able to get out of that.
You mentioned kind of as a man, there is maybe a different stigma. Not that it's, I'm sure it's always hard no matter what, but kind of being able to ask for help. I'm kind of curious, what was it like to overcome that? And, you know, and maybe trying to think how to say this. Yeah, I mean, it's maybe not as common to have those type of maybe body image issues or things like that. So what was it like to start asking for help and reach out for people, knowing that maybe that's not as common as something to go through?
Yeah, I think as I started to reach out for help, I realized how much more common it is than that, or how much more common it is than spoken about. I forget the exact number, but the amount of former student athletes who struggle with body dysmorphia, eating disorders post career is kind of crazy. There is wild and sad. But as I reached out for help, as I talked to a therapist, as I just even talked to my wife about things that I was going on, everything I got was positive and supportive and breaking down the stigmatism, the stereotypes of an eating disorder. Like, they didn't know what was going on in my head until I actually vocalized it. And then it was all about trying to get me back to, I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with you so far. Like, I'm decent to talk to. And that's what they were expressing to me. They're like, we miss you, man. Come back to us. Like, that was the message. It's like, let's get you better for you, but for us as well. We miss having our older brother. We miss having our son-in-law. We miss having our son, right? Those were kind of the things that I was getting. So once I started to talk about it more, it became more comfortable with me. Like, if you asked me a year ago, probably two years ago, if I would ever sit down and do an interview about this kind of stuff, hell no. Like, I was scared, but now I know it's okay. Like I said, it's okay to not be okay, but trying to speak with people about this kind of stuff is important. So I guess to any of the listeners here, like, please rely on the people that love you. They're there for this kind of stuff. If you have any hesitation, reach out to me. I'd love to get on the phone with you. Obviously, it's challenging to talk to about, but the more you talk about it, the more you're going to realize people are just there to try to help you get out of the darkness and this kind of stuff.
Definitely. And thank you for sharing that, because maybe I didn't realize how common it is. Mm-hmm. I'm also curious, after you mentioned your phone was blowing up, I'm kind of curious about the I guess the reaction to it and what that was like to kind of see that outpouring of, maybe I'm guessing, some people who could relate to you, or people who were learning how common it is, or being able to relate to somebody previously they couldn't. What was it like to kind of get that outpouring of support and appreciation?
Yeah, it was strange at first. Like I said, I didn't want any of this attention. That was never the point of this. But when you get an 8-year-old boy message you on Facebook asking to jump on a phone call about this, like, you're shook. That's strange. That's weird. Like, when you've had former professional athletes that you grew up watching reach out to you and try to connect with you, that's weird, right? So it was strange at first. And I always say, I don't have the answers. I'm no professional in this kind of stuff. Like, I just want to be another tool in your toolbox, someone who wants to love with you, wants to heal with you. So the more support I got, the more it's empowered me to try to help other people who may be dealing with similar things.
That's great. And kind of along those lines, in addition to, I know you mentioned you're in sales, you also recently started, correct me, did you help start Axe Sports Group or work with them? But that's an agency that's kind of helping with that life after football stuff a little bit too. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the agency was started about 3 years ago, but when that, almost the day after that stuff was published, I had the founders of the company, Ish and Jared, reach out to me and want me to join the company. We're working with universities in a great way. A lot of what we do is through NIL support, which is something I never had access to. I don't think I would ever be a millionaire, but we're helping student athletes with that. But really what I'm passionate about and why I signed up to help the organization is to help with the transition of life after sports, to be another tool in your toolbox, to help people resume right, to help people transition mentally and physically from their sport to the real world, to help with mental performance, game day mental performance, but then also how to recover from an injury, how to, you know, healthily, is that, if that's a word, how to lose weight so. More healthy. There we go.
Yeah.
So those are some of the things that we're doing now. And it's really cool to do. I've been in the sales my whole career here and I love what I do. I really do. I get to talk to great student athletes. The amount of support I get from that, the amount of people reaching out to me, Instagram, Twitter, those kind of things, or X, whatever you want to call it, has been really cool. I think we are making a great impact in people's lives, and being a student athlete, being even just a college student and transitioning in the real world is very challenging. A lot of people go through that. So if we could just impact, you know, one kid's life a day, like that would be so rewarding for me.
And kind of my last question on this is, you mentioned a few times that you feel like maybe you lost 2 years of your life as you kind of battled with some things, but what's it like now knowing that those 2 years, despite how hard they were, now are you being able to use them to help others?
Yeah, I guess it's a double-edged sword. I wish I didn't lose those 2 years, but I think it shaped me into the man I am now. And I think we could tie this conversation full circle, right? I think we could start to talk about that transition into college and how challenging it was. It made me grow up really quickly. I think that the test for those 2 years made me grow up even more. I feel very confident as a man right now. I think it shaped the image and the direction I want to get to. I was at some really dark points in my life, man. I remember getting, not to get off on another side road here, but my siblings and my wife and my sister-in-law all wrote me handwritten letters, and they handed it to me one day when I was at one of my lowest. And one of the first letters from my little brother, who's my biggest fan and my best friend, said, "Man, we don't think you're going to survive." I remember sitting in my car and crying. I was at some bad points and I fought my ass off to get out of those. I really did. It was hard, really hard. It was harder than 2-a-days. It was harder than getting my butt kicked by Mike McGlinchey. It was harder than, you know, facing Jalen Smith in practice. It really was. I'm very proud of myself, very blessed to have the people around me to help me, because I would not have been able to do it without them. I know I hurt them deeply, and those are things I'm always going to have to, it's always on my mind about how I hurt them, and I could not have done it without them, but I fought like hell. I did, and I'm proud of myself for getting through it, and I know anybody can do it. So it shaped me, propelled me here into the good days. I feel great. I'm confident. I love what I do now. I love going to the gym. I don't go to the gym to lose weight. I go because I love it. I love putting in my headphones, listening to some heavy metal music and getting a good pump. I love taking my dog for a walk. I love eating good food. I love my job. I love my wife. I love my family. So I'm a very lucky, blessed man. And it took a lot of strength to get through that. And I could not have done it alone.
Awesome. No, that's all great to hear. And I'm glad you've kind of come out to this side and that point. Last thing I want to ask you about is, if you, as you've, you know, left school, obviously now they're under Coach Marcus Freeman. I've had a lot of success in recent years. I know you're still an Iowa football fan to agree too, but I'm curious what it's been like for you to watch the team as a fan. I've heard from some other players that they're actually more nervous watching games as a former player than they were maybe when they were playing or previously. So I'm kind of curious what it's like to watch this team now, especially with the run they had last year.
Oh, that's great. I love it. I look forward to Saturday every single week. I love it. Shame on them for putting that Stanford game so late. Some of us need to go to bed, but it does make me nervous. I think I'm one of the only freaks who's like, "Oh my God, did you see that catch? Like, no, did you see that block from the right guard?" Like, no. So I do love it. I'm still a nerd about the game. I still have a sneaky passion. If I'm ever lucky enough to have kids, I know I'm going to be coaching their teams because I love it. I love football. I love following college football in particular. So yeah, I still get very nervous, but I love every second of watching it. And I hope like hell that Texas Tech beats BYU.
Well, this will come out later. So when people listen to this, they will know if that's happened and how Notre Dame's playoff hopes worked out. But yeah, definitely interesting to, I'm sure, watching that now that you don't have any say in how the game goes is different. Mm-hmm. But great. Well, thank you so much for making time to speak with me today and sharing your story and some of your struggles and how you overcame them.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me. And like I said, if anybody needs any help, please let me know, or please rely on the people that love you and care for you. They're there for you.
Absolutely. Well, for everybody listening, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back again in 2 weeks with another episode.